was remembering this morning an incident that happened with Swami Kriyananda. He's the founder of Ananda. He died in April of 2013, and after some 40 years of friendship and relationship with him, I have many experiences that are key to my understanding of the spiritual path. And I was remembering a moment that happened in the summer of 1971. It was probably around July. And I moved to Ananda Village up in the hills of the Sierra Nevada in June of 71. So it was very early on. My spiritual life started some years earlier than that with study and reading of spiritual teachings and the path of self-realization, beginning efforts to meditate. But like many people, my first exploration of how to change my consciousness came through physical, working with my body, working with yoga postures, and also in my particular case, I became very interested in diet. I became very interested in being a vegetarian, and this was like 1968, 69, when all of these movements were really just starting. A friend of mine worked for General Mills Food Company. He was an accountant for that company. And he told us that if you bought a box of whatever their cereals were, Cheerios or Grape Nuts or Flakes, he said there was more nutrition in the box than there was inside the box. And this was all like great revolution at that time. Now people are much more aware of these things. But the body is the first place for many of us. It's the most accessible way to realize the cause and effect quality of your own consciousness. You do certain things and you get certain results. So you start sensitizing yourself. Maybe it's from doing yoga postures and you calm down a little bit or you feel less painful in your body, or in my case, you begin to eat whole nutritious foods and become a vegetarian. And for many people, the body becomes the temple. It isn't that the body isn't important, but it isn't the final temple. It's the vehicle through which your consciousness can express, and therefore it's necessary to keep it, as Master said, fit and ready for God realization. But mere purification of the body is not the same as purification of the heart. As Swamiji said once, the way to God is through the heart, not through the stomach. And in fact, Swami Kriyananda and another Indian teacher named Sant Keshavdas, who's now passed into the astral world too, were having a conversation, and it was a very interesting conversation. In this particular yuga, which is this particular age on planet Earth, where we're in an upward cycle, but we're still at a very gross level in the sense of not subtle, he said, you just can't get that far by purifying the body. He said, in the highest age, where the veil between spirit and matter is very thin, just a little bit of physical tapasya, he said, and you can break through. But in this age, where matter is so gross and holds us so powerfully, devotion is the only way to make real progress. You can make the body as pure as you can make it, and it's just still too inherently heavy. I, of course, didn't know this in 1969. And so I thought, you know, it was the one way I could exercise my willpower. I became extremely strict in my diet, and I developed a strong aversion, not an inner aversion, but a strong judgmental aversion to sugar and anyone who ate it. And by the time I got to Ananda Village, I had been maybe 3 or 4 years without allowing the evil demon into my pure temple. And I thought I was pretty hot stuff. I wasn't quite into samadhi. I wasn't that stupid, but I thought that I was getting close. Swami Kriyananda has always taken a rather light attitude toward dietary things. Partly it's just his own karma. He actually said to his own guru once, he said to Master, Master, help me to overcome my enjoyment of good food. And Master said, oh, when ecstasy comes, everything goes. Don't worry about it. Which Swami accepted very gratefully. And he, in the end of his life, he would say very simply, I'm a picky eater. That's just the way it is. I like what I like and I don't like what I don't like, and that is that. And he, Master told him, actually instructed him to always have three meals a day, because when he was a young monk, he started skipping dinner so he could meditate longer. You would think that the guru would endorse that. But Master actually said to him, you must eat regularly and you must eat three times every day. And Swamiji very faithfully would sit down three times a day and have a meal, not necessarily large or elaborate, but that's what his master had told him to do, so he did that. But Master's own rule about food was what he called proper eaterianism. He said, find a simple diet that works for you and then don't think about it anymore. But again, these were not things I knew in July of 1971. And Swamiji saw in me potential, thank God, but not realized potential. And I was a little tense, I think is the only way I can think to put it. I was quite a bit thinner than I am now, and all of it was held pretty much like this. And I had long hair, which I wore in tight little braids, and I had little beady glasses like that. Sort of my habitual reality. And so I decided I had potential, but we needed to work on it. And for some reason or another, I end up on an excursion with him, going from the village, which is 20 minutes from the nearest town, into Nevada City to do something or another. And then afterwards, Swamiji, in his, which I grew to love, childlike, exuberant way, announced that since we were in town, we should go to the local ice cream parlor, which was a favorite haunt of vegetarian yogis. As we often say, it's one of the few legitimate pleasures left to a yogi. So we went there to have ice cream. They went there to have ice cream. There were 12 of us, I believe, at the table. It was two carloads of people. A long table. Swami ends up at the head of the table, and I end up at the foot of the table. And this was before I had met David, and I was just all by myself sitting here in my way. And in my mind's eye, Swamiji was so exaggerated in the energy of the whole thing, helping everyone order and just getting all this ice cream on the table like this. I asked for a glass of water, no ice, thank you. And I sat at the foot of the table. He was the head of the table, the foot of the table, sipping my water like this, while everyone else around me feasted on ice cream. And again, I remember it as so exaggerated. Swami reaching out to taste everybody's sundae, people passing their sundaes around. But fortunately, I had the feeling that there was something really wrong with this picture, and it wasn't them. That the odd man out seemed to be me, and maybe I should think about that. I mean, who could say whether such a moment was really spiritually important? But it was a very long time ago, and I remember it very vividly. And I really don't think it was about ice cream or not ice cream. Later in his life, Swami had to go off sweets altogether for many different reasons. I think it was about whose point of view am I really going to follow in my life? And in order to get myself to the point where, as many of you know, when I met Swami Kriyananda, the first moment I met him, I made the decision that this was my path, and I've never looked back. I realize now in my life that was unusual. At the time, it seemed like such an incredibly glorious opportunity. How could anybody not take it? But the freedom with which I made that decision and then lived it is, I feel very grateful to have had such a karma. But to have brought myself to that point where it never occurred to me not to do that. And once I made the decision, I never looked back. People ask me questions like, what did your parents think? And when people would first ask me that question, I would kind of like, because my first thought was, well, what does that have to do with anything? I was 22 at that time. It's not that I was disrespectful of my parents, but this was my decision. What did this have to do with anyone? Now, in order to be that capable of perceiving our spiritual reality and then putting our will behind it, we have to work for a lot of incarnations to get to there. And I don't say that with anything like pride. I say that with gratitude. You know, one puts in a certain amount of effort in a certain way. It's the grace of God that if we're guided or inspired to do that. In other words, we have to have a lot of personal strength. I mean, nothing in our society right now. You don't see these huge advertisements that say, consider the spiritual path. You would be happier if you renounced everything. Do you see those? You see the National Ad Council being commissioned by the government to make advertisements that says, you don't need any of this stuff. Just renounce it and you'll be much happier. You know, happiness is within. Forget the new SUV. I haven't noticed it. Have you noticed it? Even when they do put forward, you know, powerful figures, it's usually to sell something. I mean, Apple did that great campaign with all those great creative thinkers and used it to make you think that if I buy one of their products, I'll be better at what I do, which to a certain extent is true, actually, because their products facilitate creativity enormously. But still, you don't see it anywhere. And very few parents, siblings, spouses, children say to you, oh, mommy, mommy, please renounce the world. You know, please go to God. Don't worry about me. Don't think about me anymore. Every once in a while it happens, but not often. So there has to be a lot of strength. There has to be not only the ability to perceive, which in and of itself is a very creative and very subtle reality. The world looks, it seems so self-evident that this is a material world and the material world is the real world. And to have it occur to you that there's something else going on here and that something else is far more important. I used to have a dear friend, an elder, a man who was older than I, he was elderly, I think is actually the right word, although he was probably younger than I am now. But I thought of him as elderly. And we used to have interesting philosophical discussions, which would always end at the same impasse. And the impasse was, he felt that the external world was the causative force, and we needed to adjust things externally, and then we would be happy. I felt that the inner reality was the only reality. Adjust your consciousness and everything will follow. And we would enjoy getting to that point, and then we would just quit and go have a cup of coffee because there was no place to go from there. But just a moment, I lost the thought here. But just the ability to be able, the subtle ability and the grace of God to be able to see it. Then the willingness to separate yourself sufficiently to be able to pursue it. And then to be able to stand up against opposition and persecution when people tell you that, you know, what you're doing is crazy and you really don't know what's actually going on and how well do you know those people, and maybe especially in America. I mean, the worst thing in America is to be considered gullible, you know, to not be shrewd. The American method has to be shrewd like this. So you always have to stop and think. Well, yes, I had a wonderful experience there. Yes, I had a deep, heart-opening experience. Yes, my Kriya initiation was the most marvelous night that I've ever experienced. But I don't know, maybe, like this. And then we wait and we watch. This is an American quality. It's worse in some European countries, but it's not true everywhere in the world. But to be able to buck that cultural reality and feel what you feel and know that it's true takes a lot of personal power. And then, when you've just got it just right and you can stand against everyone and your way is right, you get to become a disciple. And all of a sudden, it's not your point of view at all anymore. You are suddenly in relationship to brothers and sisters on the spiritual path. You're in relationship to these masters, you're in relationship to teachers, you're in relationship to scripture, and every ounce of you has worked so hard to not listen to anybody, and that's been the right thing to do, because there was nobody around to teach you. And then suddenly when there is someone around to teach you, some vibration even if it's not personified, and you suddenly have to use all that strength to perceive on a much more subtle level and a much different level what is true, to let go of the habit, to let go of that which has served you until now, We literally outgrow that particular suit, but we're comfortable in it. And this is where our strength has come from. And as I was saying about sitting there at that table with that ice cream, I don't know if that was a critical moment. 20 years later, I had less than 10 years later, I had a moment in time where I was struggling with something which seemed much more important to me at the time. And Swamiji was very casual about helping me. In fact, he hardly helped me. He didn't help me at all. And later he said, well, that was a critical test. If you hadn't passed that, you would have left the path. Oh my God, I said, why didn't you tell me? He said very simply, I didn't think it would help if you knew. Interesting. But nonetheless, we have these times. Was the ice cream that time? Well, in a certain sense, I actually think it could have been. Because everything in front of me was contradicting everything I was committed to. And I had really good reasons for my point of view. I could give him all the facts and figures. It would have been easy just to walk away at that point. These people don't really know what they're doing. But previous to that, I had had an experience in which I felt Kriyananda knew more about what he was doing than anybody I'd ever seen. And he certainly knew far more than me. But then this is when discipleship really starts. It sounds good until your desires and your point of view and your ego is actually contradicted. And then how do we make decisions? And that's the whole spiritual path. How do we make decisions? And oddly enough, you see, in a paradoxical way, it's really about trusting yourself. Because you come to the spiritual path because something has persuaded you. And you have to hold on to that clarity of the first moment, or the first true intuition, and not let all the niggling little mice of doubt that chew on it. You know, am I going to believe what I felt from Swami Kriyananda when I first met him, or am I going to let ice cream become more important? He doesn't follow my dietary plans. Or he doesn't agree with me about my political opinions. Or he doesn't really want me to continue in the way I want to continue. On what basis am I making these decisions? I remember once Swamiji sent me to speak to this particular woman who was arguing with him in ways that he didn't think were appropriate, but he didn't feel that he could directly solve the problem. He often would do that because he sometimes... Let me phrase it this way. He always needed to maintain the relationship with people. So he wouldn't push people past the point where they would turn against him, but he would often send some of us around the back, you know, to give someone a chance. Because someone relating to me, we can have a different conversation. So I'm talking. Swamiji sent me to speak to this woman, and we happened to be driving to San Francisco together, which was going to give us a lot of opportunity. But I knew the issue was delicate, so I sat in the car. This is also rules for how do you counsel people. I sat in the car and we were just driving and I'm praying to Master and I'm saying, if there's an opening here, you know, you've got to help me. And then just almost as soon as I prayed that, she turned to me and brought up the subject. Just like that. And so we had a conversation. Finally, I said to her, you know, you have an opinion, he has an opinion. I said, just on the face of things, who do you think has a greater or lesser chance of being influenced by egoic self-interest? You know, he who's been meditating and doing Kriya for the last 30 years, you who've been on the path for, you know, 24 months. And then she had a sense of humor. She said, let me think about that for a minute. But you see, it's just that beginning of, I have been wise up until this point, and this has served me well. But have I reached the apex of wisdom? What are the possibilities now? Is it possible that I can learn something that I don't know? And you don't have to abandon who you are by any means. In fact, that would be foolish. But you have to be open to the fact that this is not the end of the road. That there is a whole universe in front of me, and I simply want to be interested in that road. You know, the grace of God can just move us in directions we can't even imagine. I'm going to follow on with the food stories here for just a moment. This I wrote in my book about Swamiji, but this was the Christmas eggnog event. I used to be in charge of the retreat kitchen. which was at that time also the community kitchen. This is 1971. I'm way back at the beginning of Ananda when all we had was the meditation retreat. About 30 of us lived up there. Nobody had their own kitchen, so everybody had to come to the kitchen, which is not that beautiful facility they have now, but was this pathetic, primitive dome that leaked like a sieve and was really something else. It was ready to be torn down in 1971, and we used it for about 20 more years. I can't believe it. And when it rained, it literally just leaked, just all in it. You had to keep the cookbooks under the counters. And one winter day, I walked up to cook breakfast at 5 in the morning, and that it had snowed, and I'm looking at this round dome, which is now covered with snow, this exquisite pattern of icicles just around the whole platform, just went from the platform down to the ground. It was gorgeous. I'd never seen anything like it. I thought, my goodness, I've been so inattentive. You know, it's been cold like this for many days, and I've never noticed, and I spent quite a bit of time just admiring those icicles. Fabulous. I went inside. Of course, the reason it was icicles is because the pipes had frozen and burst, the kitchen had flooded, and all the water had run out under the dome and down like that and made this beautiful thing of icicles. So, welcome to Ananda 1971. So, no, I mean, just, you know, you have to figure out what to do. So I went over to the shower house and opened the hot water heaters and emptied buckets of water and just made breakfast. What can you do? I thought it was all just a lark. Anyway, I'm in there. I am as fanatical as I can possibly be still, because this is just before Christmas. So I'm still feeding everybody just right. And I had this strange idea that you have, that if the recipe calls for sour cream, you can just whip up tofu and it'll be just the same. If it calls for chocolate, you can throw in carob. You know, just somehow, how those thoughts get into your mind, I don't know, but the devil made me do it. So Swamiji, this was the first year we were going to have this really beautiful Christmas, and he wanted to make eggnog. He thought that would be not with liquor in it, but just the regular eggnog. He had just had these ideas of traditions that we should start. So there's this recipe, which everyone calls Swami's eggnog recipe, which he himself copied off the bulletin board at the Safeway. But anyway, so he hands this to me. It calls for sweetened condensed milk and regular milk and sugar and a few other things like that. I don't know where my brain was. I decide instead of sweetened condensed milk, I can put raw honey into a thick mixture of powdered milk. What? Anyway, so I did. And I did a few other things that just made this god-awful mixture. Did I not taste it? Could I not taste? I have no idea. Swami said later that I was so committed to my mental theories that I really couldn't taste. That I really literally couldn't taste things. I would mentally decide it must be good, and then I would decide it was good. Ego, you see? And so Christmas Eve afternoon, it's beginning to snow. It's turning into a blizzard. The meditation retreat is 6 miles up an unpaved road. Swamiji comes up early because he senses, of course, there's something terribly wrong going on up there. And he asks if he can taste the eggnog. Yes, sir, of course. So I give him a little cup and he puts it in his mouth like this. He's so conscious about his responses. So he puts it in his mouth. He does not swallow it. He does not say anything. He walks over to the sink and he very delicately goes, like that. And what he's put in his mouth falls out of his mouth. He says, it doesn't taste quite as I remember it. So I sort of tell him, you know, we have this little discussion. I explain that I was making a little differently. He says, I'm not sure that's really the best way to do it. We look out the window. It is now a full blizzard. The nearest store is 6 miles down the dirt road and about 6 miles on the paved road to this little tiny convenience store next to a gas station. He turns to Seva, who's, you know, my friend. She has this little green VW bug, which that bug could do anything. He says, why don't you go to North San Juan and buy the right ingredients? I said, sir, there's a blizzard. He says, oh, Seva's a good driver. And he just sent her out. And she went to that little convenience store. They had all the ingredients. Unbelievable. About an hour later, she comes trundling back up through the snow, and I made it correctly. And that evening, so many people said, Divine Mother's so cute, isn't she? Oh, Asha, the eggnog, it just made the evening. Like that. Who has a better chance of being influenced by God and influenced by ego? You know, I could have argued all of those points of view, but why would I do so? Are we here to just perpetuate exactly what we already are? Do we want the sheer pleasure of dying exactly as we were born? I mean, where will that take us? And that doesn't in any way dispute what we've already done. It just says that much more is possible. And I'll finish this. This is a story that I tell sometimes, but I've never been able to understand the message, and maybe I'm getting it by telling all three of those stories in sequence. Here I am cooking for the whole community, and they're all dependent on me to eat because nobody has their own kitchens. And we're growing also at the farm, but it's winter, and only a few crops in that season are possible. One was kale. That was before kale became so trendy. Kale was a little more obscure at that point. And Jerusalem artichokes, whatever. They don't look like artichokes. They look like ginger roots. And it's, even for me, who I'm pretty fanatical, it was not my favorite. And however, it was available from the garden. It was fresh, organic. And I served kale and Jerusalem artichokes at least once, sometimes twice a day, to those poor saps up there, poor dears. They come in every day, and there it was again. And I didn't even, like, I didn't have any gourmet ideas about how to make it good. I just basically put it out there for them. And apparently behind my back, a delegation went to Swami and just basically said, do something, you know, take her out of there or fix it because we're dying on the vine on this one. By this point, it had begun to just penetrate my fanatical little brain that maybe something was wrong here. I was just kind of like picking up that something was wrong and that feeding people was more about the vitamins in it, that there was some heart quality that was missing. And I began to try, but I still couldn't taste anything, so I couldn't tell. And I was making an effort, but my efforts were not succeeding. And then Swamiji came to me after this delegation had come, but again, so delicately. He said, you know, that dish today that you made at lunch, it was a little bland, he said like that. And I immediately said, oh yes, Swamiji, I know it was. I tried to make it like this, but it just didn't come out. And what he saw in me was that now I really wanted to know. And so then he took a second step. He said, you know, a lot of what you make is a little bland. What a perfect choice of word. You know, not god-awful uneatable, which is really what people were saying to him. A little bland. Oh, yes, Swamiji, but I don't know what to do about it. He said, well, you know, I could teach you to cook. And I said, could you? Would you? Okay. So that weekend, this Swami Nirmalananda was coming to visit. And Nirmalananda wasn't quite as big as Trilanga Swami, who weighed 300 pounds. But Nirmalananda was a solid Swami. He was a solid man. And he liked his three meals a day. And he stayed with Swami as a friend for about 3 days. And Swami said, why don't you come and we'll cook together for Swami Nirmalananda the whole time. I said, great, I show up with my pen and my notebook. You know, I am ready. I have my mental concepts and I'm going to get some new ones like this. So we start cooking. And Swamiji, he's not a recipe cooker, he's an intuitive cooker. He pulls a little of this, pulls a little of that, gets too much of this. Oh, that's too much. Well, we'll balance it with this, and then we'll throw this. And I'm, you know, frantically trying to write everything down like this. And again, I think there's something wrong with this picture, and I don't think it's Swami. So I just put it down. And I just really did very little but hand him things, because it was impossible to learn in the way that I thought you learned. But I just entered in. I handed him things and washed his dishes and stood next to him in like this. And we cooked steadily three meals for 3 days. The last dinner, for some reason, we were all lying around on the floor. That's how the picture that I have. Maybe we were sitting. And Swami says, why don't we have fruit for supper? And then Seva's there, and she says, oh, that's a nice idea. I'll make the fruit salad. Swami said, that would be nice. And she's up on her way to the kitchen, and he says, no, no, no. And then he says it in this very exaggerated way. I'm teaching Asha to cook like that. And so then he took me up to the kitchen, and we cut fruit like that. The next morning, I knew how to cook. I have no idea how. And ever since then, and I say it with, you know, with no pride, because it's not something I did. I don't know how it happened. But somehow or another, God can give you anything if it's supposed to be yours. And Swami just shifted me from a mental concept into a divine flow. And it's not difficult to take no egoic credit for something you didn't do. And through learning that anywhere, you see, you can learn it everywhere. And that's the point. He was able to get to me through cooking, because in a very real sense, cooking was so unimportant to me. I was raised in an intellectual family in which it meant nothing, nothing. And so I didn't have anything at stake. I just could enter into it, okay. But once you get, oh, look, things flow through me. They aren't me. And far from contradicting this power that I am trying to express, it amplifies it literally to infinity. From the smallest things, you know, from the littlest seeds, from the seemingly incidental incidents, our spiritual life is formed. Take care of the moments, Master said. Incarnations will take care of themselves. God bless you.